Osho, Take It Easy, Volume 2, Talks on Zen Buddhism. Discourse Number 7, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
する生地の海の雨こぶね底抜けての地雲たまらず仏には心もならず身もならずならぬものこそ仏なりけり梅雨と消え幻と思いなずまの影のごとくに身は思うべし仏とて他に求むる心こそ迷いの中の迷いなりける蜂蕎麦の濁りに染まぬ梅雨の実はただそのままに真如実相。Bhagwan,
on the sea of death and life, the diver's boat is freighted with is and is not. But if the bottom is broken through, is and is not disappear. The mind cannot become the Buddha. The body cannot become the Buddha. Only what cannot become the Buddha can become the Buddha. As lightning which disappears like dew, which vanishes like a phantom, thus think of yourself. A mind to search elsewhere for the Buddha is the foolishness in the very center of foolishness. The dew on the lotus leaf, undyed by its color, just as it is the real form of the Buddha.
An elderly woman came into a doctor's office, exclaiming, "Doctor, my stomach hurts." The doctor said, "But madam, I am a doctor of philosophy." For a moment she forgot the pain and then seemed puzzled. "Philosophy? What kind of disease is that?" "Yes, philosophy is a disease, and not an ordinary one either. It is not a common cold, it is cancer. Cancer of the soul. Once a person is lost into the jungle of philosophy, he becomes more and more entangled into words, concepts, abstractions, and there is no end to it. One can go on and on for lives together. Philosophy is all mind game. Mind perpetuates through it. And the truth can be known only when you are in a state of no mind. So the philosopher never comes to know the truth unless philosophy is dropped utterly in toto. One cannot know what truth is or what God is. Philosophy thinks about God and hence goes on missing God. It goes on spinning and weaving theories around and around. It never hits the target. It moves in circles. It creates one idea about God, and then that idea creates another idea. And ideas don't believe in birth control. They go on reproducing themselves. Mind secretes philosophy, creates philosophy, lives through it. Without philosophy, the mind cannot exist even for a single moment. The mind has to be a Hindu, or a Mohammedan, or a Christian, or a communist. The mind cannot remain even for a single moment in existence if it is not Hindu, not Mohammedan, not Jaina, nor Christian. If the mind has no philosophy to depend, it dies out of starvation. If there are no props to support it, if a continuous nourishment is not given to it to think more and more, the process stops. Philosophy keeps it going. Buddhism is not a philosophy. Not, at least, in Buddha's being or in Ikku's being. Those who have realized one thing absolutely. The truth happens in a non-philosophic state. Truth happens in a state of not knowing. Truth happens in innocence. Truth happens when there are no clouds of thoughts moving in your consciousness, when the sky is absolutely clear, when there is no abstraction, when you have no idea what God is or what God is not, when you don't believe in God and you don't believe in no God, when you are simply in a state of not knowing, you don't claim any knowledge, that non-claiming consciousness begins to open up. All knowledge burdens and closes you. And Zen is one of the medicines to come out of the disease called philosophy. No other school has been able to devise such powerful medicines to come out of the world of philosophy as Zen has done. Buddha has not taught anything to believe in. He was not a teacher in that sense, because he has not taught. He was, on the contrary, an anti-teacher. He took away all teachings that people were carrying. Slowly, slowly, he helped his disciples to become utterly nude, naked. Philosophy is a beautiful dress that the mind clings to. Once philosophy is dropped, mind is ugly. No one would like it. It is nauseous. Then to drop the mind becomes very easy. In fact, to cling to it becomes impossible. One has to drop it. That dropping comes inevitably and necessarily on its own account. What exactly philosophy is? It is a pretension of knowing without knowing anything at all. It is thinking. Thinking always means the man is ignorant but is trying to make up. Whenever you think, that simply shows you don't know. Either you know or you don't. How can you think? What can you think? If I say whether God exists or not, and you say to me, I will think over it, what you are going to think over it? Either you know or you don't. It is just simple like that. What you are going to think about it? And whatsoever you think will be your fabrication, will be a lie. Thinking consists of lies. But one can prove to oneself that those lies are truths. One can argue for them. In fact, truth needs no argument. Truth is self-evident. Only lies need arguments. They are not self-evident. They need witnesses. A truth is simply truth. Unargumentedly, it is there. That's why the greatest declarations of truth are absolutely without any argument. In the Old Testament, there is no argument for God. It simply states God is. No argument is given. No proof are contrived. The Upanishads simply declare. They are declarations, announcements to the world at large, but with no argumentation behind it. They are not syllogisms, just poetic assertions. Somebody has known and he declares. If you ask him, what is the proof? He says, you can also know. When Vivekananda reached Ramakrishna, he asked this question. Can you prove to me that God exists? And Ramakrishna said, I cannot prove that God exists, but I can make you know. Are you ready? This very moment, Vivekananda was shaken to his very roots. The man was standing there and asking, are you ready? This very moment I can show God to you, but there is no proof. Vivekananda had not expected this. He had seen many other philosophers before. He was expecting something like that, that Ramakrishna will give few proofs, will argue for God, will destroy the proofs that say God does not exist. He had never come across a man of real knowledge. This was for the first time. His throat went dry. He could not utter a single word. He was simply dumb. For a moment everything stops. And Ramakrishna touched his chest with his feet. And he fell in deep ecstasy. When he came back, he was trembling. What he had seen was impossible to believe. He had fallen out of the mind for a moment. That touch of Ramakrishna's feet. He had fallen for a moment out of the mind. Just the same happened last night. Sarjano was there. And Vivekananda must have been in the exact situation as Sarjana was last night. And I told him to hold my feet in his hand for a moment. And it happened. For a moment he slipped out of the mind. The impact of no mind, if you are ready, can take you into a state of no mind. And there is knowing. Knowing is not through the mind. It is always through the no mind. It is not through the knower. It is only when the knower is not. And philosophy goes on accepting the knower and goes on trying to make some toys, theories, doctrines to believe in so that one can deceive oneself. And one can go on and on forever and forever. I have heard an ignoramus managed to get himself invited to a party attended by world-renowned scientists. Among them was Albert Einstein. The illiterate guest immediately made a nuisance of himself by dogging the illustrious physicist's heels and offering what he thought were very profound observations. "Tell me, Dr. Einstein," asked the pest, "what, in your opinion, is the difference between time and eternity?" "Sir," answered Einstein, "if I took the time to explain the difference, it would take an eternity." In fact, Einstein is being very mild, mellow, generous. Even in an eternity, the difference cannot be explained. Even through an eternity, if you go on discussing what is time and what is eternity, you are not going to come to any conclusion whatsoever. 5,000 years of philosophy and not a single conclusion in the hands. Yes, not a single conclusion. No two philosophers agree. They only agree to disagree. They are constantly arguing against each other. There is no possibility of agreement because two lies cannot agree. And two truths agree so deeply that they become one truth. Then they are not two. The agreement is so total. That's why it is said there is only one truth. There cannot be many because the agreement is so infinite and so total and so whole. Then whenever there are two truths, they immediately jump into one and become one flame. All Buddhas agree. But on what? That cannot be said. If you say it, it becomes part of philosophy. It remains unsaid, but it can be experienced. Because philosophy is a pretension, it believes in great words. It believes in phrase mongering. It creates, fabricates such great words that people can be impressed by them. Art critic one, "I think the neoplasticism of the abstract design proves the mystical, metaphysical and non-humanistic approach to the objective concept of abstraction." Art critic number two, "Yes, you have a point there. In fact, it is obvious even from a casual glance that this painting was created by paranoid critical activity brought about by spontaneous dynamic sensations sometimes made by somnambulistically inclined campanologists who create a picture of transcendental, non-curvilinear and curvilinear objects expressing subjective feelings in a cubistic manner. Art critic third, I fully agree with you both. It is a rubbishy painting. Philosophy goes on creating such bombastic words. It is never simple. It cannot be. It cannot afford to be simple. Because if it is simple, you will see that it is a lie. It has to be very, very roundabout, indirect, zigzag, never straight, never to the point. Its whole effort is how not to come to the point, just to go on in every direction, but never come home, and create such bombastic words that you can impress idiots. Only idiots are impressed by those bombastic words. Truth is simple, very simple. So simple that a child can understand it. In fact, so simple that only a child can understand it. Unless you become a child again, you will not be able to understand it. It is an experience, not a speculation. But once you get addicted with great words, it is very, very difficult to bring you down to the earth. Those big words give you great fulfillment in the ego. Once a person's mind starts enjoying great words and great ideas and complicated theories, it is very difficult for him to descend to the earth. He flies in the skies. He remains in the high towers of his mind. He never comes to the fact, to the truth. Because truth is simple. And what will happen to his philosophy? Samantha was a six-year-old who liked to exaggerate almost everything she saw or did. One day she was looking out of the window when she called to her mother, "Mummy, Mummy, come quickly. There is a lion walking in the road outside our house." Samantha's mother looked out of the window but could only see a small ginger cat. "Samantha, you are lying again," she scolded. "Go upstairs to your room immediately and pray to God for forgiveness for being such a naughty little girl and beg him to stop you from telling so many lies." Samantha ran up to her room sobbing. A short time later she came down to her mother and said, "I have prayed to God like you said, Mummy." And he said that he too thought the ginger cat looked rather like a lion. Once you have started enjoying exaggerations, big words, bombastic theories, it will be difficult for you. You will try to collect every kind of proof to convince yourself and others that you are on the right track. Once the illusion happens to you that you know, and that is the illusion philosophy gives, that you know, then it is very hard to drop that illusion, because then you become ignorant again. That is one of the most difficult things for you to be with me. When you come with knowledge. And the whole effort here is to help you drop that knowledge. You had come here to acquire a little more knowledge, not to drop that which you have, you had come to accumulate a little more. You had come to gather few more arguments for that which you already believe. And I am telling you to drop all that you know, because you don't really know. It is a false hallucination. You have created the idea that you know. Yes, it hurts to drop it, because then you again become ignorant. And it has taken your whole life to acquire little bits of knowledge from here and there, from the school, the college, the university, and the priest, and the books. And you have been studying, and you have been searching. And with great effort, you have accumulated a little bit of knowledge. And you feel that you may not know the absolute truth, but you know enough to move towards truth. When you come to me, you are shocked, because I am telling you again and again that all that you know is just bullshit. You simply drop it. Your God is just a fiction. Your prayer is just your fear. Your love, just your pretension. You are pseudo, root and all. You are just a falsity. Drop all this and become ignorant again. Because from that ignorance, you can grow. The techniques of Buddhist meditation are nothing but techniques to help you to get out of the knowledge trip. The whole trip is just garbage. And remember, knowledge and knowing are not synonymous. Knowing is existential. Knowledge is just intellectual. Knowing is out of intelligence. Knowledge is just memory. It needs no intelligence. In fact, to avoid intelligence, people become addicted to knowledge. It is a cheap thing to become knowledgeable. And then they get excited about useless things. Sometime years ago, Art Buchwald told the story in the New York Herald Tribune of a Hollywood producer whose hobby it was to collect rare books. He loved his avocation so much that he spoke about it constantly, boring his friends who were tired of hearing about it. One day they decided to play a joke on him. They hired a bit actor and brought him to lunch. When inevitably the subject came up, the actor said he had an old German Bible around the house for years, but it smelled so bad, he finally gave it away to an aunt in Santa Barbara, who printed it. The rare book collector asked, "I don't know, Gatain something," the bit actor said. The producer dropped his work, "Not Gutenberg." The actor said he believed that was the name. The producer jumped up from the table. "Let us go," he screamed. "We will hire a plane." "Go where?" asked the actor. "To get the Bible, man. Don't you realize you have one of the first books ever printed? It is worth $300,000. The actor stood up excitedly. Then suddenly he sat down again. "It can't be worth anything," he said. "Why not?" asked the hysterical producer. "Because," the actor replied, "somebody named Martin Luther scribbled all over it." nor the producer must have gone mad, must have fallen in a swoon. People get excited about trivia. And they think they are doing great work. All your hobbies, all your search, all your so-called spiritual work can be reduced to a single thing: decorations for the ego. And the ego is the only barrier that is preventing you from knowing that which is. These sutras of Iku are very pragmatic. That is the climate of Buddha. Buddha is a very practical man. That's why he is non-philosophic. He is a pragmatist. He wants the facts and the truth. And he wants to go directly. He does not want to go here and there and round and round. He wants to beat the bush, not around it. The first sutra: on the sea of death and life, the diver's boat is freighted with is and is not. But if the bottom is broken through, is and is not disappear. That's the way how to let philosophy drop. What is philosophy? It is a constant fight between two camps. The camp who believes in is and the camp who believes in is not. One says God is, another says God is not. One says this and the other says exactly the opposite. One proposes the thesis and another proposes immediately the antithesis. This game between thesis and antithesis is what is called philosophy. The whole game can be reduced to a simple formula. Is not. The theist says is, the atheist says is not. One says the soul exists, the another says there is no soul. One says life has a goal, the other says there is no goal. One says soul is immortal, the other says nonsense. And this has been continuing down the ages, through the ages. No conclusion. Buddha says the whole game is futile. For certain basic reasons, the game is futile. Life, in its very structure, is dialectics. It depends on the polar opposites. Thesis, antithesis. Everything automatically turns into its opposite. Birth turns into death. Day turns into night. Love turns into hate. Hope turns into despair. And vice versa. Despair again turns into hope. And night again turns into day. And hate again turns into love. And death again turns into birth. The whole wheel consists of the polar opposites. Buddha says to choose between these poles is to be wrong. See the whole of it. Don't say is or is not. Don't become part of a camp. Don't become part of a school or a doctrine. Because all doctrines are partial. And each doctrine is trying to prove that this is the whole. This is the trap of philosophy. Naturally, when you say God is light, how can you believe somebody saying God is darkness? Obviously, he is denying you. You are at daggers with each other. But Buddha says, just see, light turns into darkness every day. Darkness turns into light every day. So you are not really contradicting each other. You are complementing. Polar opposites are not opposites really, but complementaries. So there is no way to choose. And you choose and you will be in difficulties. You choose love and then love changes into hate and anger. And then you are in a difficulty. Because you were thinking love will remain love forever. You cannot. Clinging to love forever. In your very choice, you have chosen hate too. Love, hate is one relationship. In fact, we should drop love and hate, two words. We should make one word, love, hate. We should drop day, night, two words. We should make one word, day, night. Birth, death. That will be truer, closer to reality. Our division is false. When you are in love, you think, now I will love forever and forever. And you have forgotten how life functions. By the evening, the love is gone. And the anger is arising. Is bound to arise. You cannot do otherwise. In choosing love, you have chosen hate too. That is the other aspect of the same coin. But now you are in misery. You think you are betraying. You think how it is happening, why it is happening, why to me? Why cannot I love forever? Why my lover cannot love me forever? In the morning he was so much interested in me. And now he wants to be alone, left alone. What has happened? Where I went wrong. Nobody has been wrong. Nothing has happened. All is happening as it should. And soon this anger will go and you will be hugging each other again. And love will be there. And you will again forget. To understand life, this is one of the very fundamentals to see. That each thing implies its opposite. And each thing automatically turns into its opposite. If you don't want any enemy, then don't make friends. Make a friend and you have started making an enemy. Only friends can become enemies. If you want never to be unhappy, then don't seek happiness. If you seek happiness, you are seeking unhappiness too. Unhappiness comes in the bargain. It is part of the game of happiness. Happiness cannot exist without it. Life exists amidst death. This is one of the greatest insights of Buddha. So he says there is no point in choosing. Somebody says God is and somebody says God is not. They are simply choosing one aspect of reality. God is totality. Is plus is not. So if you ask Buddha, what do you say about God? He will say, what can I say? If I say is, I am wrong. If I say is not, I am wrong. If I say he is both, I puzzle you. Then you see that I am confusing you. So better I will keep quiet. I will not say a single thing. I will be silent and I will teach you also silence. When you want to know what God is, become silent. Don't choose this way or that. Philosophy is a choice. When you say I am a Hindu, you have chosen. You are saying in that I am not a Mohammedan. And God is a Hindu, is a Mohammedan, is a Christian, is a Jaina, is a communist, and all, and none. Why everything turns into its opposite? Nobody wants that it should be so. Still it turns. It is the way of existence, Tao, Dhamma. It is how things move. Just as fire burns, it is fire's nature. So is this the nature of existence that it automatically turns into its opposite. Why it turns into its opposite? Because the opposite only is opposite seen from the surface. Seen from the deep core of reality, it is not opposite but complementary. Just think of a world where no hate exists. Do you think there will be love? That's what philosophy will say. There are philosophers of love, philosophers of peace, who say if there is no war in the world, there will be peace. And it looks so logical, so mathematical, so appealing, that if there is no war, there will be peace, certainly. When war disappears, there will be all peace and peace and peace. That is not true. Listen to Buddha. Buddha says war and peace are together. If war disappears, peace will disappear automatically. There will be neither war nor peace. How you will know that this is peace? You will forget all about peace. Just think, if death disappears from the world, will you be able to know that you are alive? Impossible. How you will know that you are alive? Death is needed to define life. War is needed to define peace. Enmity is needed to define friendship. And hate is needed to define love. So they are not separate. They define each other. They depend on each other. If one disappears, the other is bound to disappear. Philosophy chooses. There are pacifist philosophers who think there should be no war, only peace. Then there will be only peace. That's what Bertrand Russell was saying. It is not possible. Krishna is far more closer to truth when he says sometimes there is peace and sometimes there is war. Both exist together. Our minds choose logically. Logic never allows the opposite. Existence depends on the opposite. Hence, logic and existence never meet. And philosophy is a logical endeavor. The more logical you are, the less is the possibility to know what the truth is. Buddha says, this is the dilemma, the predicament of human mind. To be or not to be. But both are together. You cannot decide. If you decide to be, you have decided also not to be. And vice versa. No choice seems to be the right choice. Choose and you choose always something wrong. Only choicelessness is right. Don't choose. Let things be as they are. When it is war, let it be. When it is peace, let it be. When it is love, let it be. When it is not love, let it be. You remain aloof, watching. a witness. Just see that understanding. You are just a witness. And things turn into their opposites on their own. Peaks are followed by valleys. Highs are followed by lows. And so on and so forth. There is nothing you can do. If you don't choose, the doer disappears, stars evaporating. Then you can only be conscious of whatsoever is the case. This is breaking through the bottom. On the sea of death and life, the diver's boat is freighted with is and is not. But if the bottom is broken through, is and is not disappear. Choicelessness is the way to get out of all these clingings. Choicelessness is the way out of this world. Mind always chooses. I have heard Mullah Nasruddin was walking with his son along a country road behind their donkey, who was contentedly nibbing the grass along the way. A man, seeing Mullah and his son walking and sweating profusely, remarked, "Look how foolish they are, walking instead of riding." Hearing this remark, Mullah and his son climbed on the donkey and rode through the next village, where they heard an old man exclaim, "They ought to be ashamed, making the poor donkey carry two riders." Mullah dismounted and walked while his son rode the donkey to the next village. There, Mullah heard this comment, "Poor old man, that boy ought to be ashamed, making his father walk." Then Mullah got on the donkey while his son dismounted and walked for some distance. Finally, another villager observed, "Look at that old man riding while his son has to walk. How cruel." Mullah rubbed his beard, shook his head and said to himself, "You cannot please all of the people any of the time." What was happening in this story? It is one of the most famous Sufi stories. What was happening? Mullah was doing one thing, people were suggesting the antithesis. And seeing the point, he chose the antithesis. Then somebody suggested the antithesis of the antithesis. And so on and so forth. And he was always choosing and always choosing. This is how people are moving. This is the way of the mind. You always choose. You choose one thing, and sooner or later, from somewhere, the suggestion will come. Choose the other. Because you become tired of that which you have chosen. And the other is as significant as this. And when you are tired of one thing, naturally you start thinking of the opposite. You have been fasting too much, then naturally you start thinking of food. When you are eating too much, you start thinking of fasting. When you have been running after money too much, one day you decide to run from the world of money and all, and go to the Himalayas. When you reach to the Himalayas, by the time you reach there and you sit in your cave, you have not even settled there. And you start thinking of the world and the money and all. You become afraid, sitting in the cave, what will happen to you? Tomorrow, how you are going to get your food? Now you have no money at all. And in the night, you become afraid, alone, in the forest. No protection. Now you see the point, what was beautiful in the house. You were protected. And there was a shelter and safety. Now, when you were in the house, you never thought about the protection and the safety. It was accepted. It was taken for granted. You were thinking of other things. You were thinking that you are almost closed in a prison. You were thinking of the open skies and the sunlit peaks and the beautiful forests and the silence, the primordial silence of the Himalayas and the snow-capped peaks and that eternal beauty. You were thinking of these things. And when you are sitting amidst that eternal beauty, you will forget about it. You perceive only that which you don't have. That which you have disappears from your perception. Perception happens only when something new happens. You see only the new. The mind tends not to see the old. What is the point? You have seen it already. Now, for the first time, you start thinking of the house and the beauty of it. No fear was there. Now here is fear and fear. You cannot sleep in the night. Although the primordial silence is there, but the silence is too much. It is heavy. You cannot tolerate it. It creates fear in you. Whenever you come across primordial silence, you start feeling very afraid. Because you have lived in the world of language, you have become accustomed to it. Have you not seen this restlessness? When you meet a person in the train, in the bus, a stranger, you start feeling restless. He starts feeling restless, unless you become introduced to each other. Unless you bring language in, the silence hurts both. You fidget, he fidgets. And finally somebody has to break the ice. That ice is silence. Somebody has to ask, where are you going? Somebody has to bring the language in. Once the language comes in, communication happens. Then you are part of a human world. Have you not heard the famous Zen story? Four persons decided to go into silence for 1 week. Few hours passed. Then one said, I wonder whether I have put the fire out in my house or I have left the fire on. The other says, you fool. You have spoken. And we had decided not to speak. The third said, what are you thinking? You have spoken too. And the fourth said, I am the only one who has not spoken yet. It is difficult to be silent. Language is our blood, our bones, our marrow. Man lives in a sea of language. Don't you see it happening continuously? That the people who are very, very articulate become very important. The man who can use language cleverly becomes a leader, a great leader of man. All his skill may be just linguistic. A man who is not very, very efficient at language remains a third-rate man, because this society lives through language. It is said of Joseph Stalin that he used to ask his cronies always, whenever some new name will bubble up in the talks about somebody, some author, some poet, some philosopher, some thinker, he will always ask the same question, is he a genius? And if the answer was yes, then the genius will disappear within days. He will not be found anymore. He will be killed. Why? Why Stalin was so much afraid of a genius? Because these people are dangerous. Genius means one who is very, very clever with language, who can write beautifully, who can speak beautifully, who is articulate. These are the dangerous people. They create rebellions, revolutions, they become leaders of men. If the answer was no, that he is not a genius, just a second-rate author or a poet, then there was no problem. Man lives through language. And you will know only that your language is so essential to you when you have moved to the Himalayas, never before it. Here, it is taken for granted. Here, sometimes sitting in your room, you feel very good when you are alone. So much silence. But that too is because there is so much noise all around. In contrast, it is beautiful. If you go to the Himalayas within a few days, you will become frightened because there is no contrast anymore. It is good to be silent for a few hours because it gives you relaxation from language. But then again, you are ready to talk, to communicate. People living in the world think of the beauties of those who have renounced and gone to the monasteries. And people living in the monasteries simply feel that they have missed this chance to live. Life is there outside, where people are enjoying, rejoicing, indulging, eating, loving. Real life is there. Monks become sad and think constantly of the world. This is one of the basic things to see about the mind. Buddha says, once you choose one thing, sooner or later you will have to choose the opposite. You will become tired of it. You will start forgetting about it. You will not perceive it anymore. And you will start thinking of the beauties of the opposite. And each thing that you choose is only a part. It is never the whole. If it is the whole, there is no need to choose. Choice is of the part. Can only be of the part. You cannot choose the whole, because then there is no point in choosing. If you say, I choose life, I choose death, then what really you are saying is that I don't care a bit whether it is life or death, it is all the same to me. I don't choose. Choicelessness brings you to the whole. Choice is always of the part, necessarily so. And then one person goes from one choice to another, becomes a driftwood, from this bank to another bank, from that bank to this bank. This is how you have been moving down the ages for so many lives. On the sea of death and life, the diver's boat is freighted with is and is not. But if the bottom is broken through, is and is not disappear. Jump exactly in the middle, through the middle. Don't choose. Remain alert and don't choose. Let life happen with no choice on your part. As if you are just sitting in a movie. It does not depend on your choice. The movie is moving. The pictures are coming. Going. The story is unfolding. It doesn't depend on your choice. But even seeing a film, you start choosing. You start thinking if this man had a little better character. if this man was a little more moral. You have started choosing. And you know that it doesn't depend on your choice. It is already there. It is going to happen as it is going to happen. You can just relax and enjoy whatsoever is happening. Yes, by not choosing, the film will not stop. It will continue. But it will have no more effect on you. You will remain undistracted, undisturbed. You will remain centered. That's the beauty of choicelessness. Krishnamurti is right when he again and again emphasizes choicelessness. That is also the taste of Zen. Zen has created many methods how to break through the bottom. So you can jump out of choice, duality, opposites. Kuan is one of the most important methods. The master gives a certain puzzle. It is no ordinary puzzle to the disciple to meditate upon. Its extraordinariness is that it cannot be solved. It has been made with every care so that mind cannot supply any answer to it. It is unanswerable. For example, the sound of one hand clapping. The disciple is to meditate upon the sound of one hand clapping. Now there can be no sound. Logically impossible. Two hands will be needed. Sound cannot be there unless two things collide. Only then sound can be created. One hand cannot create sound. That is impossible. Now that has to be meditated upon. The disciple knows it is impossible. The master knows it is impossible. Day in, day out, the disciple will meditate on the sound of one hand. And he knows it is impossible, but the master says, go on meditating. Because it is impossible, it is important. He goes on meditating. He drives himself almost crazy, naturally. If you think about it, you will get slowly crazy. Your mind will say, what are you doing? There can be no sound. But the master says, go on meditating. You have to find out. There is a sound, the master says, which is not created by two hands. You go and find out. Sometimes months pass and sometimes years. But one day, the mind comes to its ultimate peak. The mind starts really going crazy. It spins and round it goes and moves. And it cannot produce any answers. It comes to its ultimate capacity. From that capacity, the breakdown and the breakthrough. Suddenly all is silence. The question has disappeared. The questioner has disappeared. The mind is no more there. No thought is there. All is utter silence. That is the sound of one hand clapping. This is Satori. This is breaking through the bottom. Then there is no is and no is not. Then you cannot say God is. And you cannot say God is not. Then the whole is. Then the one is. Undivided. This whole is God. Our Nirvana. Our Tao. The mind cannot become the Buddha. Now this is a koan. The mind cannot become the Buddha. The body cannot become the Buddha. Only what cannot become the Buddha can become the Buddha. Now the whole nonsense of it. But Zen uses nonsense in a very sensible way. It has sense in its nonsense. Now you cannot make anything out of this statement. The mind cannot become the Buddha. The body cannot become the Buddha. Only what cannot become the Buddha can become the Buddha. That's why people like Arthur Koestler think that Zen is all nonsense. On the surface, yes. At the deepest core, the most sensible thing that has ever happened on this earth. It is the sense of nonsense. These are not philosophical statements. That's where Arthur Koestler goes on missing. These are not philosophical statements. These are devices. These are devices to drive you so crazy that out of the sheer craziness of it, the mind comes to a halt. How long you can go repeating this sutra? The mind cannot become the Buddha. The body cannot become the Buddha. Only what cannot become the Buddha can become the Buddha. How long? This has to be meditated upon. It is a koan. The master will say, find out the meaning of it. Now there is no meaning. Nobody can find out the meaning. But if you try to find out the meaning, and you will not be able to find it out, but the very effort will lead you to a certain state. I have heard it happens. A woman was getting very fat. She went to the doctor. The doctor gave him a bottle of beautiful red pills and told her that within a month, at least 15 pounds weight will disappear. And within a year, slowly, slowly, you will become normal. She was very happy. She went home. She had two daughters, 5 and 7 years old. They liked the bottle and the red pills so much that they swallowed all the pills between themselves. Now the woman was very much afraid. She phoned to the doctor. The doctor said, don't be worried. For a few days, the girls will go crazy. They will not be able to sleep at all. They will remain wide awake. And they will have great energy. And they will remain restless for a few days. And they will jump and they will scream. And they will rush all around and run all around the house. But nothing really harmful. Within 7 days, they will cool down. So don't be worried. But those 7 days were hell. The girls won't sleep at all. The whole night they will shout and scream and jump. And they had so much energy the woman could not control. They drove the woman crazy. In 7 days they cooled down, but the woman was just completely broken. But one thing happened. She lost 15 pounds of weight. Now that is a totally different thing, not a logical conclusion out of it. But that's what really happened. It may not have happened by the pills themselves. And the doctor had said in 1 month you will lose 15 pounds. She lost in 1 week. This is what a koan is. You will not get to the answer. But something else will happen. That is the sense of the nonsense. You will be thinking of the meaning. And there will be coming no meaning because there is none. So how it can come? Arthur Koestler is right that it is a nonsense statement. And yet, he has missed the whole point. It is a nonsense statement, but trying to make sense out of it, you will drive your mind crazy. You will become so restless, so disturbed, so stirred, that you will reach the climax. You will start boiling at 100 degrees. And at that point, the evaporation happens. That is a byproduct. Suddenly, the whole mind is gone, and all its problems and all its philosophy and all its answers and questions and all, root and all, has simply disappeared. You simply look around and there is no mind. You look out and it is not there. You look in and it is not there. You search everywhere and it is not there. You cannot find yourself. And this is the moment of Satori, when you cannot find yourself. When you cannot find yourself, you have found. Now the ego is not there. There is great silence. The mind cannot become the Buddha. The body cannot become the Buddha. Obviously. Because the mind is one half and the body is another half. And both have been believed in. There are many religions who believe in the mind. The majority of religions believe in the mind. And they are against the body. They all teach anti-body practices. Christianity is anti-body. Jainism is anti-body. They teach you how to destroy your body deliberately. They teach you how to destroy all the energy that the body has, because that is your enemy. If you can destroy the body, you will know God, or you will know truth, or whatsoever it is. They live in the mind. They have chosen the mind. There are religions who have chosen the body. Very few. And they are not called religions either. The Charvakas in India. They were as religious as Christians and Jainas, but their religion consists of the body. That's why the majority of religions will call them non-religious, anti-religious. They are not. Their religion is totally different of the polar opposite. They believe in the body. They say there is no mind, no soul, all nonsense. You just live your body, eat, drink, be merry. The religion of Epicurus is of the body. But both are wrong according to Ikku, according to Buddha, according to me too. Both are wrong. Because man is a whole, organic whole. Mind and body are together. In fact, man is not mind and body, but mind-body. The body is just the visible part of the mind, and the mind is the invisible part of the body. They are one energy. The mind cannot become the Buddha, true. It cannot become. Against the body, the mind cannot become the Buddha. The body cannot become the Buddha. Against the mind, the body cannot become the Buddha. If you believe in the first, you will become spiritualists. If you believe in the second, you will become materialists. But in either way, you will miss real religion. Only what cannot become the Buddha can become the Buddha. And now the strange statement. The mind cannot become the Buddha, the body cannot become the Buddha. Both cannot become Buddha separately, taken apart. But both together can become the Buddha. In fact, both together are already the Buddha. As lightning which disappears like dew, which vanishes like a phantom, thus think of yourself. This is again another meditation. As lightning which disappears like dew, which vanishes like a phantom, think of yourself. All is momentary. Only for the moment, like the dew in the morning, the sun will rise and it will disappear. Or the lightning in the clouds, you have not even seen it, it is gone. All is momentary. Nothing abides. Everything comes and disappears. Not only that, everything disappears and turns into its opposite. Seeing this, there is nothing to cling. Thinking this, one becomes unattached. One starts being in a kind of let go. One allows whatsoever happens. One has no obsession that it should be so. One has no claim on existence. One simply trusts and flows with existence, wherever it takes and whatsoever is happening or is going to happen. One has no predetermined goal. As lighting which disappears like dew, which vanishes like a phantom, thus think of yourself. A mind to search elsewhere for the Buddha is the foolishness in the very center of foolishness. And this is the greatest foolishness, to search for Buddha. Because you are it already. Again and again this has to be repeated. This is the greatest statement, the most potential. Someday you may hear it. Someday it may strike you. Someday it may just penetrate your heart like an arrow. Heart. And in that very moment you will be transformed. Hence it has to be repeated again and again. A mind to search anywhere, elsewhere, for the Buddha is the foolishness in the very center of foolishness. The greatest foolishness is one. All other foolishnesses arise out of it. That is the mother of all other foolishnesses. What is that? To search for Buddha. You will never find Buddha anywhere, because he is already you. If you search for him, you will miss. The seeker is never going to find. The finders are those who stop seeking. Again, there are two parties, two philosophies. Some say seek outside. There are religions who say God is there above in the heaven, outside you. Worship God. Create a temple. Make a statue, an image, an icon. Learn the right prayer and the right form of ritual and serve God. And you will find him somewhere outside. One kind of religion which searches outside. Hinduism, Christianity, Mohammedanism. There is another kind of religion that searches within. Jainism. It says, look within. God is not outside. Yourself is the Supreme Self. God resides in you. So go in, but search still. Few search outside, few search in. Zen says, don't search at all. Searching out, searching in, there is no difference. To the extent that we know all is dream, to that extent we become unattached to whatsoever happens, to things and to the self. The more you become detached towards things and towards the self, you start losing the idea of the inside and the outside. That division is again the same duality, in, out. There is nothing in, nothing out. All is one. Our mistake is to look for truth outside or inside. The great mistake is to look at all. Then what to do? The Zen formula is simple. Non-doing. Wu-wei. Sitting silently. Doing nothing. Neither looking out nor looking in. Just not looking at all for anything. Just being yourself. And in that moment, Buddha is known. Buddha is your very being. Buddha exactly means in Buddhism what God means in other religions. The dew on the lotus leaf, undyed by its color, just as it is the real form of Buddha. And a great rebellious statement to be remembered always. Somehow deep inside the idea persists in you that Buddha is somebody special. That when you will become a Buddha, you will be somebody extraordinary. That is again the old seeker's mind, which cannot believe in that which is, but always hankers for that which is not. Listen to this statement. The dew on the lotus leaf, undyed by its color, just as it is the real form of Buddha. Be awake and listen. Just as you are, just as you are, I repeat, you are the Buddha. Nothing has to be added to you. Nothing has to be taken away from you. Just as you are, exactly as you are, in your utter ordinariness, you are Buddha. The day you will recognize this, you will be surprised. You will start laughing. How ridiculous has been the whole search. And how ridiculous have been your problems. Listen to these two stories. A monk once asked a Zen master, "Does a dog have the Buddha nature?" He replied, "Yes, it does." The monk then asked, "Do you have the Buddha nature?" He replied, "No, I don't." The monk then said, "But I thought everybody has the Buddha nature." The master replied, "Yes, but I am not everybody. In fact, I am nobody. So how can I have the Buddha nature?" He has the Buddha nature. This is the way of Zen people to express themselves in puzzles. But he has made the point very clear. In your nobodiness or in your ordinariness. And the ordinariness has to be such that you even don't claim that you are a Buddha. If you claim, you are not. That's why he says, "Yes, but I am not everybody. In fact, I am nobody. How I can be a Buddha?" When one knows, one does not claim. Another story. A Zen master was worshipping at a statue of the Buddha. A novice came by and asked, "Why do you worship the Buddha? I thought Zen teaches us not to. Do not some Zen masters spit at the Buddha?" The master replied, "Some spit at the Buddha and some worship the Buddha. I prefer the other. But it is all the same. Life continues as it is. Some worship the Buddha, some spit on the Buddha. Life continues as it is. The man of Zen has no choice only preferences and make clear to yourself the difference between a choice and a preference. A choice says that I am very serious about it. A choice says, this way I would like to live, the other way I would like not to live at all. This is the way to live. That is the way worthless. A preference simply says, I like this, but if it doesn't happen, then the other is also good. There is no seriousness involved in it. Naturally, a Zen master also has preferences. When he sleeps, he does not sleep on the thorns. He sleeps on his bed. This is a preference, not a choice. If he has to sleep on the thorns, he will sleep there too. If the bed is not available and the sleep is coming on, he will sleep on the thorns too. But this is not a choice again. Just in that circumstance, that is the only possible thing to do. He eats food. He does not eat stones. That is a preference. Not a choice. Remember, a Zen master also walks and gets through the door, not through the wall. That is just a preference. That's what this master is saying. Yes, some spit at the Buddha and some worship the Buddha. I prefer worship. But he is not serious about it. A Christian cannot be so easy about it. If somebody spits on Christ, he will be mad. He will kill the man. He will not be able to tolerate this. Although Christianity goes on talking about tolerance and love and forgive the enemy, but he will not forgive this enemy. He will kill this enemy. If you spit on the Buddha and a Zen master is worshipping, he will just look at you and will think, he prefers spitting, I prefer worship. There is no choice involved. A great detachment. See the point. It is of immense value. Preference is okay. Choice is not good. And when it is said, become choiceless, few foolish people start thinking that they can't prefer now. Because they think preference is choice. They start thinking that now they cannot prefer. In India it has happened. There are Mahatmas in India, saints, very well known, worshipped by thousands, whose whole prestige is because they don't prefer. If they are eating and you just sit in front of them and piss there, it's okay. Or they may be sitting just in dirt. It's okay, because they are thinking this is choicelessness. Because of this idea, India has become so dirty. If Mahatmas are doing such great things, then followers, if not that great, but they also follow a little bit. They should not choose. India has become so poor. You need not do this mistake. If there is a possibility to be rich, prefer being rich. Don't prefer being poor. But remember that this is a preference, not a choice. If riches one day disappear, because all is fleeting, the dew on the lotus leaf, then it is perfectly okay. Then you be poor. Don't choose poverty. Don't choose richness. But preference is perfectly good and sane. If you can be healthy, prefer to be healthy. If you cannot be, then it is okay. Then accept your illness. But I am not saying choose illness. That calamity has happened in this country. For at least 4,000-5,000 years, this country has lived in such a nonsensical philosophy. Don't choose. That's why this country remained poor. Don't prefer even. So whatsoever is okay. People have been dying and starving. People are ugly. People are ill. Their life is a dog's life. But they go on. They have lost energy to live, to change, to transform. Religion became very poisonous in India. This should not be repeated. I have lived in poverty, I have lived in richness. And to be frank with you, richness is better. So is health. So are all good things of life. But preference. Preference simply means you are not very serious about it. If playfully it is possible, good. You are not deadly set for it, that if it doesn't happen, you will commit suicide. That if you are not the richest man in the world, then you would not like to live. That is foolishness. Zen people don't choose. They don't choose the world, they don't choose renunciation of the world. But they have lived in the world, they prefer. They say this seems to be more natural. They live like ordinary people, just as you live, but they live with an extraordinary intelligence. They live with a great awareness. The more and more choice disappears and preference takes place, you become more and more intelligent, more alert, more conscious. A lucidity, a grace arises in your being. The dew on the lotus leaf, undyed by its color. Iku is saying, be the dew on the lotus leaf, although from the outside the dew will look colored by the lotus leaf. If the lotus leaf is green, the dew drop will look green, will look emerald. But it is not colored. It remains uncolored. It is not affected by the lotus leaf. That is only appearance. The Zen man lives in the world but uncolored. He may have a wife, he may have children, but he remains uncolored. The dew on the lotus leaf, undyed by its color. He moves through the world, uncontaminated, unpolluted by it. The world never enters in him. That's why he is not worried to get out of it. That he is not interested going to the Himalayas. Why? For what? He knows the world is not in him. So what is the point of going anywhere else? The person who is escaping from the world is afraid of the world, because when he is in the world enters into him and he cannot resist. He is incapable. He is impotent. He is not yet aware enough so that the world cannot enter into him. To avoid this, he is escaping to the Himalayas. But how he is going to become more conscious in the Himalayas? If the world cannot make you more conscious, Himalayas cannot make you. Certainly, it is impossible for the Himalayas. The world is a challenge, and intelligence exists only when there is challenge. It is sharpened by challenges. Greater challenges and greater intelligence happens. The dew on the lotus leaf, undyed by its color, just as it is the real form of Buddha. The shopkeeper in the shop, and the worker in the factory, and the farmer on the field, the dew on the lotus leaf. If uncolored by the leaf, then there is no problem. You can be a farmer, or a shopkeeper, or a clerk, or a master. You can be anybody. That is only the form. Deep inside, remain unattached to whatsoever is happening around you. Preference is okay. Don't choose. And you are Buddha. This very body, the Buddha. And this very earth, the lotus paradise. Enough for today.